Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is an extra episode of our paranormal afterlife. In this episode, I'm going to be talking about the physical medium, Leslie Flint. Across the long and turbulent landscape of psychical research, certain names stand out. Not merely for controversy or spectacle, but for sheer endurance. Leslie Flint is one such figure, a man whose mediumship spanned more than half a century, witnessed by hundreds, recorded in thousands of hours of audio, and defended until his final breath. In the annals of spiritualist history, many mediums generated temporary excitement, only to be later dismissed as frauds, their reputations collapsing under scrutiny. But Flint is different. His case has persisted. His recordings remain. His sitters, many now long gone, testified with unwavering certainty that they had spoken once more with husbands, wives, siblings and children tragically separated from them by death. And remarkably, despite decades of attempts, no single comprehensive debunking has ever truly dismantled the phenomenon of his direct voice seances. Flint himself made a bold claim that few mediums dared to utter so plainly, "I am the most tested medium of all time." On the surface, that might sound boastful, yet within spiritualist archives and parapsychological literature, it becomes difficult to deny that he was examined, constrained, recorded, and analysed under conditions far stricter than many who came before or after him. To believers, this record of resilience makes him one of the strongest evidential cases for post-mortem communication in modern history. To others, at the very least, he is an enigma, too persistent to ignore, too confounding to dismiss. What separates Leslie Flint from most other mediums is not simply that voices reportedly spoke in seance rooms, that had been claimed since the Victorian times, but rather the nature of those voices. They were external. They were audible to all present simultaneously. They did not come through Flint's own vocal cords, but materialised from points around the room, often moving about like unseen speakers. They conversed casually. They interrupted. They laughed. They argued. They displayed not generic sentimentality, but sharp memory, humour, and relational nuance. There were, according to countless sitters, moments where the dead did not merely speak, they returned as fully developed personalities. To understand how one man became the focal point of such long-standing debate, one must return to his unlikely origins, not in the mansions of mystics or halls of occult society, but in the quieter, humbler world of East London. Born on January 20th, 1911 in Hackney, East London, Leslie Walter Flint entered life at the edge of poverty. His early years were marked by disruption, family instability, displacement, and emotional solitude. He later spoke of spending long hours alone, drawn inexplicably to cemeteries. While most children found such places eerie, Flint found them peaceful. Among gravestones and monuments, he felt a presence, not sinister, but companionable. He said he would speak aloud to the dead, expecting answers. These childhood imaginings might be dismissed as the romantic retellings of an elderly man remembering his youth, yet multiple biographers have noted a pattern common among sensitives and mediums: early affinity with silence, solitude, and death. Flint was not formally religious, nor particularly educated. His path into spiritualism did not come from doctrine, but instinct. He did not seek fame, rather he sought understanding of what was already intruding into his perception. As a teenager, he worked odd jobs. One of the most formative was an attendant in a cinema. It was there, in the dim hush of projection rooms, that he would reportedly fall into trance-like states while listening to reels spin. He claimed that voices began to whisper around him in the darkness, some near his ear, others from corners of the room where no one stood. He did not yet identify these spirits of the dead. He simply knew that someone was speaking. It was only after attending a spiritualist meeting in the 1920s that Flint heard others describe similar experiences. In that moment, he found not merely a belief system, but a framework for what had been unfolding in his life all along. He began sitting in development circles, honing his ability to remain conscious yet receptive, allowing what spiritualists call manifestation energies to accumulate. Soon he discovered that when conditions were right, dim light, harmonious company, emotional openness, something extraordinary happened. In earlier periods of spiritualist demonstration, most mediums relied on trance speech, meaning the medium themselves spoke while claiming to be momentarily inhabited by spirit. Flint was different. His spirits insisted on using something beyond his own vocal mechanism. In spiritualist terminology, they fashioned from ectoplasmic substance a temporary voice box situated in midair. This phantom organ, allegedly constructed from material exuded by Flint's own body, enabled the spirits to produce fully formed, audible speech independent of his own mouth. Is this claim biologically plausible? Under normal scientific models, no. But in countless reports from sitters, the voices did not come from Flint's direction. They moved about the room, sometimes coming directly beside a listener, whispering into their ear, or emanating from the ceiling. One sitter reported that the voice of her deceased husband drifted in from behind her left shoulder so closely that she momentarily turned, expecting to see breath in the dark. The diversity of voices was staggering. Men, women, children, thick accents, modulated tones. Some spoke in archaic vernacular. Others referenced modern affairs unknown to Flint. And in perhaps the most compelling evidential cases, many used personal terminology known only to the deceased and the sitter. When such personal details came forward, not in vague generality, but in precise familial acquaintance, sitters found themselves weeping openly in the darkened room. One recurrent voice became the emblem of Flint's seances. Mickey, a spirited Cockney boy spirit who claimed to have died in the earlier 20th century. He was cheeky, sarcastic, and irreverent, often teasing Flint himself. Far from solemn reverence, Mickey's appearances lent an air of friendly informality, almost as if one had stumbled into a lively gathering rather than a ceremony of the dead. Another frequent visitor was a spirit identified as Dr. Charles Marshall, a calmer, more dignified personality who acted as a facilitator. It was Marshall who allegedly controlled much of the seance mechanics, ensuring sitters behaved respectfully and spirits took turns. Some researchers have noted that the interplay between Mickey and Marshall suggested a structured system of spirit control, implying intelligence beyond Flint's own theatrical invention. Now we are going to hear a recording from one of Leslie Flint's seances. This is the spirit of Ellen Terry, and she's talking about the afterlife. This recording is from decades ago, and I've used my recording software to clean up the audio. So if it sounds too good to be an old recording, just realise that modern software can be very effective.
On the sphere in which I now exist, there is such tremendous opportunity, and there are great souls indeed who have progressed through sphere to sphere and experience to experience. We have the most wonderful form of existence that one can have to experience, and yet all the time one is experiencing this existence in life, one is ever conscious of the possibilities of that which still lies further ahead. It is impossible, I think, for any soul to describe the spheres that are more advanced, the spheres that are near the earth, because they are near the earth, can be depicted and described, and no doubt have been described and depicted many times. But the souls who have gone into an atmosphere and condition far removed from earth can never help to recapture in words and expression to you that which they inhabit. But I can say that that which constitutes my life is full of beauty, full of colour, full indeed of every aspect of loveliness that words could depict or experience could experience. There is so much. There are great buildings, beautiful to behold. There are great cities in which all can be found that is good for the life of the individual.
By the late 1930s and into the Second World War, Flint's reputation began to grow. Unlike many flashy performers, he operated in modest settings, small rooms, church basements, borrowed parlours. Yet demand increased, especially as wartime grief surged across Britain. Mothers who had lost sons to air raids came seeking one final word. Wives prayed to hear a familiar cough or affectionate nickname. And astonishingly, many claimed they did. Flint's seances were conducted in darkness, not as theatrical embellishment, but, he insisted, as a spiritual necessity. Spirits, he said, were delicate in materialization. Light fractured the ectoplasmic structure required for speech. Skeptics argued this was convenient. Believers understood it as established spiritualist principle. Regardless of one's stance, attendees described the experience not as eerie, but sacred. They spoke of feeling enveloped in an atmosphere thick with emotion, as though multiple presences gathered unseen among the living. Over and over, testimonies record similar themes. Voices recognizing long-forgotten pet names, referencing private letters, recounting humorous stories from years before. On many occasions, multiple voices spoke concurrently, something nearly impossible for Flint to replicate alone. He would often be bound or gagged, sometimes even with coloured water in his mouth, while voices continued to emanate. To dismiss all this as trickery requires proposing that Flint was a master illusionist, performing flawlessly for decades under countless observational conditions, never faltering, never being conclusively exposed. Many scientists have indeed claimed such things are possible. Yet one must ask, to what end? Flint accumulated little wealth. He lived modestly. He never toured with grand shows. Unlike other mediums of his era who lavished in publicity, Flint was almost reclusive. He did not seek renown, only validation. Among the most fascinating and controversial records from Flint's seances are those involving historically famous spirits. Some of the well-documented cases included purported communicators such as Oscar Wilde, Charlotte Bronte, Mahatma Gandhi, Rudolph Valentino, Elizabeth Fry, and even Queen Victoria. These voices did not come solemnly pronouncing doctrine, but spoke with wit, intelligence, and self-awareness. Oscar Wilde's alleged communication is particularly notorious. In one seance, the voice identifying as Wilde quipped about his enduring fame, lamented how posterity had reduced him to epigrams, and commented sharply on literary critics. To some listeners, the style was irresistibly Wildean. To others, it was too performative. Still, one must admit, to sustain Wildean wit extemporaneously, in perfect comedic rhythm, without visible preparation, requires remarkable mental agility. If this was merely Flint improvising in pitch-black rooms, he was not only a ventriloquist, but a satirical genius. The voice claiming to be Queen Victoria, too, presented unexpected candour. Rather than regal proclamation, she spoke with humility, reflecting on the burdens of monarchy and the illusions of earthly title. If fabricated, it was nonetheless a striking departure from the stiff stereotypes often imposed upon historical royalty. And herein lies one of the most compelling aspects of Flint's mediumship. The voices did not always conform to what sitters expected. Many expressed changed perspectives, as though enhanced by decades or centuries in spirit existence. This subtle psychological evolution, the idea that the dead continued to grow, gave Flint's seances a depth rarely found in simplistic afterlife narratives. One of the strongest arguments in favour of Flint's authenticity is the degree of scrutiny he endured. Across the 1940s and 1950s in particular, several psychical researchers, audio experts, and skeptical investigators arranged sittings under increasingly strict conditions. Flint was asked to speak with his mouth sealed using adhesive tape. He agreed. He was asked to hold coloured water or even pebbles in his mouth to prevent speech. He did. In one experiment, he sat with his mouth filled while independent microphones recorded voices speaking clearly from other parts of the room. Onlookers reported that his jaw could be audibly heard not moving while the voices continued. Could ventriloquism account for this? Some have suggested that rare individuals can project sound with their throats without moving their lips, but even ventriloquists require modulated airflow, and the production of multiple overlapping voices, some male, some female, some childlike, seems beyond standard technique. Additionally, in many sessions, objects such as luminous trumpets would move visibly across the room while voices emerged simultaneously. If Flint orchestrated that with assistants, those assistants were undetected for decades, despite surprise inspections, mixed sitter groups, and occasional presence of police or journalists. If there is one contribution that sets Flint apart from nearly all other physical mediums, it is the extensive audio documentation of his seances. While most earlier mediums relied on witness accounts and handwritten testimonials, Flint's era allowed for magnetic tape recording, and he embraced it fully. Today, more than 500 recordings of his sessions survive, some over an hour long, filled with non-stop dialogue between sitters and spirits. Listening to these tapes today is a strange and often moving experience. The voices vary not just in tone, but in spatial position. One hears a childlike voice dancing about the microphone, then a deep baritone interrupts from the far left, then laughter erupts from above. On certain tapes, sitters gasp audibly as voices appear right beside them, startlingly real. Some modern audio analysts argue that reverb patterns suggest acoustic space rather than internal projection. Others dismiss such interpretations. Yet the real impact of the recordings is not in technical debate, but in emotional resonance. One can hear gruff fathers apologizing to daughters, spouses expressing tender remembrance, children reassuring parents that they are not lost, but joyful in spirit realms beyond comprehension. These are not stiff pronouncements, they are conversations. One cannot help feel, even when maintaining critical distance, that something was happening in those rooms. Be it spiritual or psychological, it had unmistakable reality to those present. Beyond the tapes and the formal research reports lies perhaps the most compelling evidence, personal accounts. A particularly poignant story involves a widow who had come to the seances armed with only a single thought. If my husband speaks, he must say Banbury cakes. It was an obscure phrase known only between them, referencing an inside joke from their honeymoon. She did not mention this request aloud. She held it silently in her mind. Halfway through the seance, amid unrelated chatter, a cheerful male voice burst out laughing and exclaimed, "How about Banbury cakes, eh?" Her legs reportedly gave way beneath her. One can argue coincidence. One can argue telepathy. One can even argue subconscious clairaudience. But for the woman, and many like her, no rational argument could outweigh what they felt. By the 1960s and 1970s, Flint began withdrawing from public demonstration. He grew weary of criticism, bureaucracy, and sensationalism. He preferred small private sittings with loyal friends and spiritualist researchers. He passed away in 1994, still maintaining, without hesitation, that every voice was genuine. He did not recant, he did not hedge, he did not die wealthy, he died steadfast. In the final measurement, what do we call Leslie Flint? Fraud, mystic, or pioneer? The fairest answer may be undetermined, but profoundly important. For the survival hypothesis to be considered seriously, it requires cases like Flint, cases rich in duration, documentation, and diversity of witness testimony. If even one of those voices was genuine, then the boundary between life and death is more permeable than modern science allows. Today I was talking about the physical medium Leslie Flint. And my book on verified near-death experiences is out on Amazon, and you can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife, or click on the button on my homepage, pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.